Is it my imagination, or has Ross developed a northern accent whilst he's been away? It's funny being told you can choose a psalm to preach on. I mean, how do you decide? There is one member who said that I should preach on the entirety of Psalm 119, but knowing that Jeff was leading, I didn't think that would work. Psalm 22 is quite good. I am a worm and not a man, but possibly not. Or for the sake of Esther and Lydia, be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. Or maybe, the last one, I'm sorry, maybe if we're in Gloucester, from Psalm 18, he reached down from on high and took hold of me, he drew me out of deep waters. I think we tend to think about the Psalms as amazing words of praise and worship, which they are. But if you look closely, you'll see that's only about 50% true. The other 50% is generally made up of laments and complaints and anguish poured out to God. And I think that's actually really important, because God is far more interested in honest prayers than anything else. Psalm 139 is slightly different to both of those, however. And I chose it because of these words which sit on the wall in my study. It's more of a contemplative... I knew I would be able to say that word. It's a psalm of contemplation. And it's actually quite philosophical. Now, I'm sure that will send all of you to sleep. So I think I better start talking about what it's about before you doze off. So what is it all about? Well, if you read the commentaries, they'll tell you it's about this and it's about this. It's about God's omnipresence and about God's omniscience. Now, I know you're not Greek scholars, but I'm sure most of you know that omni means all. Presence, surprisingly, means presence, where the English word comes from. And science in this context means knowledge. So God being ever-present, always, everywhere, and God knowing everything. God does know everything. It's a fact. There's not really any point in debating what God would be like if he didn't have certain attributes, because God is God and he is the way he is. It's a way of spending time writing papers for philosophy, but it doesn't really achieve anything. God is omniscient. But that's not quite what David is saying in this psalm. What David is saying is that God is omniscient because he's omnipresent. David is saying, you know everything, O Lord, because you're always with me. You know what's going on with me because you're always there. Now, arguably there's no real difference in a truly philosophical sense, but there's a difference in the quality of the knowledge, and it's saying something very specific about what God is like. Let's say, for example, to try and make this clear to you, you went on a long journey to somewhere far off and desolate and horrible, Scotland, for example. Were you to phone me when you got there, then I would know that you had made it to your destination. On the other hand, if I went the entire journey with you, then I would know that you have got there. It's knowledge in a different sense. And that's what David is trying to make clear. Also, it's worth noting that this obviously comes from the Old Testament, because all the Psalms come from the Old Testament. The concept of God being intimate and close, we tend to think of as a New Testament concept because of Jesus. And we have this very dangerous idea of the God of the Old Testament being scary and distant. I want you to notice something in your NIVs, which doesn't work in every translation because they do it slightly differently. But in verse 1 and in verse 4, where the word Lord appears, if you look closely, you'll see it's in capital letters. Now, for the biblical scholars among you, Paul, you know what that means. For the rest of you, in case you haven't read the preface to the NIV, the translators use that form of the word Lord with capital letters whenever the Hebrew uses the covenant name for God, Yahweh, Jehovah. So David is saying, the God of the universe, the Father God, the Creator, has searched me and knows me. There is no distance in God. An intimate, personal, all-knowing God. As far as I can see, there are essentially two possible reactions to discovering that this is true. We can get scared, we can pretend it's not true, we can run away and hide, or at least try to. It is quite intimidating to think that God knows all of your thoughts, all of your actions, the bits you don't want anyone else to know. Or we can react as David does, with immense joy and love and praise. The reason I chose this psalm is also slightly personal. The verse I showed you is on my wall, as I said. On the last two occasions that I've spoken from here, we've ended up talking a lot about Christian maturity. I have a very good friend by the name of Ags who, in my mind, defines what it means to walk with Jesus for many years. And at the times of greatest difficulty in my life, she's been friend and mentor and wise counsel, and often a parent that I didn't have. And to be honest, at the times when I most needed it, she's been Jesus for me. On at least three occasions, she's taken me to this psalm and read it to me. So you understand why it means a lot to me. So it breaks down into sort of three rough sections. Not perfectly, because the concepts overlap somewhat. But in the first 12 verses, David talks about what God is like. And then in verses 13 to 16, it's sort of David sees how he fits into this universe that belongs to God. And in verse 17 to 24, we see David's reaction to how God is, how David fits in. So verses 1 to 12. O Lord, you have searched me and you know me. Once again, you know me because you've searched me. It's that personal knowledge. And it's detailed. Never lose sight of the fact that God is incredibly interested in individuals. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you know it completely, O Lord. Nothing is new or surprising to God. And I love this verse. You hem me in behind and before. You have laid your hand upon me. Wherever you go, God is with you. And I say with David, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. And he explores the theme a bit further. Where can I go from your spirit? How about if I go up to the highest possible place? You're there. How about if I make my bed in the depths? You are there. How about if I go to some far-flung, wild and unpleasant places? Scotland, once again. Still, you are there. If I settle on the far side of the sea, even in America, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. Surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me. Even darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. Can you see how, if you're not particularly keen on God, if you're trying to run away from him, this is a terrifying section of the Bible. Whatever you do, you can't get away. You can't hide what you've done. You can't escape from his presence. On the other hand, if you see God as the parent who's calling you back, the perfect father that Jesus describes, and these are the most reassuring words you can read anywhere. Whatever I do, I can't get away. This will come as a shock to some of you, but you are amazing. Please indulge me slightly in a minor biology lesson. I have been very restrained. You have, on average, roughly, the estimates on this are incredibly variable, actually, and no one's actually got around to counting, 100 trillion cells, which is that many. I've just lost a few scratching here. You have 46 chromosomes in each cell, which are 23 pairs. You get one copy of each from your father and one copy of each from your mother. And each of those is made up of DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, just to prove I can say it. This is obviously DNA down the side of the picture. And if I can, here we go. This stuff that goes around the edge here, that is ribose and phosphate. It's a constant chemical structure that's the same all the way through. These bits in the middle here are called the bases, and there are four of them: arginine, guanine, cytosine and thymine, which are generally referred to as A, C, G and T, just because it's easier. You only find those four in DNA, and basically the sequence of them, when you have an A followed by a C followed by a T, is how the genetic code works. Now, 3.2 billion bases make up you, although only about 3% of that is useful. Most of you is junk, in case you're wondering. The most recent estimate in a paper published this year is that human beings have 20,488 genes. Now, that's actually a very surprising number to most biologists. We were expecting it to be somewhere around 150,000, and gradually over the last decade with the Human Genome Project, the estimate has been calculated down and down. There really should be a lot more genes making up a human being, but we have a very complex process. There are two things that go on. One is called alternate splicing, the other is the way the genes interact with each other, and we actually have far less genes than we thought we would need to make you work. Now, in each gene, you have a sequence of three bases. Any sort of three bases will then correspond to an amino acid. String of amino acids makes a protein. Proteins are the stuff of life. Cells are made of proteins plus a few other things, but all the other things that are put together in the cell are controlled by enzymes, and the enzymes are proteins. So basically, genetic code makes proteins. Proteins make cells. Cells make tissues. Tissues make organs. And organs make bodies. Dead easy. Interesting thought for you, and I speak as a biologist first and foremost. I don't think the most amazing thing about you is your biology. Ponder this for a moment. The things that you value most in the world have no physical or material existence. What do you value most? Love, honesty, trustworthiness, fidelity? The thing about being human is you're made in the image of God, and that has nothing at all to do with your biology. You are amazing, and I very often say with David, I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. But let's have a look at what David is saying, because it's a bit more than that as well. Verse 13, for you created my inmost being. Okay, God is all powerful. That's dead easy. But David says something slightly different. You knit me together in my mother's womb. Now, I'm not for one second suggesting a limitation on God's power. What I'm saying is that what the Bible is saying is that God does it deliberately and personally and specifically. You are not an accident. God put you together the way you are deliberately. I praise you because I'm fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. You are of value and worth because you're a human being created in the image of God and loved by God. From the very beginning, you were known by him. And in verse 16, possibly the most comforting verse you'll find anywhere in the Bible, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Nothing is by accident. God is in control. God knows what he's doing. It's interesting use of the word ordained. I'm not quite sure why David chooses that word, but I think it's worth pondering for a while, as it's not just these are the days that happen to be mine. Those are the days ordained for me by God himself. And David goes a bit further. How precious to me, O God, are your thoughts? How vast is the sum of them? Infinite, obviously, but to help you get the idea, more than the number of grains of sand in the world. Can you imagine trying to count the grains of sand on a beach? Keep you occupied for a little while. And returning to his earlier theme, when I wake, I am still with you. David understands God pretty well. We're told he's a man after God's own heart. He understands that God knows him completely and understands him. What a great thing it is to be understood. Isn't that what we all want? David knows that God does that because he's always with him. He's seen everything. I think that's worth remembering, that the hardest times of your life, God has walked every single step with you. And then he says, I'm amazing. I can see that, the way my body works, the way my mind works. And you did all that. Therefore, how much more amazing are you, O God? And so we come to, this is what God is like. So what's David's reaction to all this? David says, if only you would slay the wicked, O God. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Don't know about you, but on first reading, does the word hate jar with you slightly? Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord? Doesn't seem like a particularly Christian thought, nor a thought for those, for him who was said to be a man after God's own heart. I can think of three potential explanations for that. I don't think the Bible is telling us that we should hate God's enemies, so I don't think that's what it means. Perhaps David is simply using hyperbole. Now, I know that football fans amongst you will be familiar with that. When the opposing team has a shot that goes millimetres wide from the goal, and you know that you're so lucky not to be a goal behind, of course we all go, oh, a mile wide, nowhere near. Hyperbole. Maybe David is saying that he feels so strongly that hate is the best word to describe it, even though hate isn't exactly what he means. I think it's interesting to reflect on whether any of us have got that far along. You see, in order to get to this point, David has been reflecting on what God is like, how God knows him, and David is completely signed up to God. He's completely on God's side. He's trying to see the world from God's perspective, and he loves God so much that hate is the word that comes to mind for those that hate God. I think most of us are a bit ambivalent by comparison. Another potential explanation is just to say that David got a bit carried away because of his strong feelings. And you might hear God in the next section saying, David, I'm very glad with what you're saying and the feelings and stuff, but I'm not after hate. I don't know. I think, however you understand it, the challenge to us is to get that strength of feeling. Ambivalence is definitely the most dangerous thing to the Christian soul. We meet adversaries of God all the time. Do we care? And then the final verses. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. God is omnipotent. God is omnipresent. God is omniscient. We can react to that in several ways. But David concludes with this very simple prayer. Look at my life, Lord. Tell me what I'm doing wrong. Show me how I should put it right. I have to say, that's a pretty brave prayer. Because God has a habit of answering those ones. You see, if God knows you completely and totally, then he knows what's wrong, and he wants to put it right. Why? Well, leave me in the way everlasting. There's only one way to live beyond this life, and that's to be on God's side. What an amazing God, who's not remotely distant. This is the great Yahweh, the great I Am, who knows you completely, who personally knit you together and made you you. What's your reaction going to be? Let's pray. Oh Lord, I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made, and your works are wonderful. I know that full well. And I pray that for each of us here, our reaction to your amazing power and your amazing presence with us will be to say with David, how precious to me are your thoughts, O God. And Lord, challenge us. Show us the offensive ways in us. And lead us in the way everlasting. Amen.